And then I'm an alcoholic. We did not announce that that I was celebrating my birthday anywhere, so nobody had a chance to go someplace else if they needed a discussion meeting, which is what this is listed as. Does anybody come here tonight needing to talk about anything special? Yes, Stevie, please tell them. You want to read the Bible, don't you?
Damn right.
Does anyone have anything pertaining to alcoholism that they need to talk about tonight? We got some people here that haven't heard it before, but a lot of you have heard my story so often. If I get it wrong, just jump in and correct me, okay?
Okay.
People that have been here long enough to have heard it that often. What did you say?
Steve.
All right. I don't know why this is hard for me. You know, it's easier to do this with people that don't know you. I mean, they don't know whether you get it wrong or not. I started drinking when I was really young, and it just changed everything. I don't believe that I was probably initially designed to be whoever it was that I turned out to be. When I was a little girl, I lived in a household that was unusual. There was a lot of abuse. There was a lot of real sick behavior. There was no touching and no holding there, and everything was real restrained. I was not abused. I didn't have any physical abuse at all, and I believed that probably because of that, that I was okay. Some kind of a distance going on with my sister, and I thought that if you just did what you're supposed to do, you know, don't step off in anything, don't open your mouth, don't put yourself out in the forefront of any situation, that you can probably survive, but for God's sake, don't let them notice you. So I kind of skulked around and didn't get noticed. And I didn't make messes, and I didn't make waves, and I didn't interfere with what anybody else did. I waited to be told what to do, and I did it. And I didn't ever understand why she didn't. We were grown before I realized that it was not about her. And by then it's kind of too late for her. That kind of environment causes a person to feel restricted. At least it did me. So I grew up and I didn't make friends. I didn't interact. I didn't feel or connect with other people like I think a person should. And when I was in my early teens, I think about 13, my father lived in another state, and I went to visit him. He was practicing, and he did the things that practicing alcoholics do, and he wasn't home much. So I would sneak out the window, and nobody would notice, and I'd get out a lot, and I found my way to alcohol. I met someone who didn't mind that I was afraid to say anything, and he gave me a drink, and it was pretty nice, and I learned to talk a lot. It was like having my handcuffs taken off. It's like having the restraints removed from me. The first meeting I ever heard my sponsor speak at, she said, alcohol did for me what electricity does for a light bulb, and that's exactly what happened to me. Alcohol poured inside me, and I turned on, and it was infinitely different than it had ever been before. I was not embarrassed about how I looked or how I felt, or what I had to say. I could move around. I could interact, and I could face people. I could stand right face to face with them, and I didn't have to back up. And I liked that a lot. It was real nice. Nobody had ever paid any attention to me, and when you're hiding all the time, people don't. And so having a little attention was nice. I wandered back and forth. I was raised on the West Coast, and I wandered back and forth from Indiana, Daddy's, back to the West Coast for a couple of years, and my aunt passed away, and I married that young man that gave me my first drink. And he was a nice guy, you know. He was just a kid, and I was a kid, and we were playing at being grown-ups, and the world was changing then. It was a long time ago, and the Cuban Missile Crisis was what was happening right at that moment, and my husband was a Marine, and he went there. And when he got back, my drinking was the focus of what was going on with us. He drank too, you know, I didn't get it. He gave it to me and he drank, and I didn't understand why I couldn't do that. But I could not do the things that I did. We lived on a Marine base in South Carolina, and I got him in a lot of trouble. I created a lot of difficulties for him, and I wasn't real aware of them. I drank in blackout almost from the beginning. Somewhere in every incident of my drinking are chunks of time that I don't remember, that I don't have any recollection of. Pieces of that over time have come back, but there's still something missing in almost every situation that just left. And those were usually the behaviors that were bizarre, the things that. And I've heard a lot of people who are not alcoholic talk about how we choose, how we have selective memory, and we choose to do. Well, I didn't choose to forget anything, and today I do not choose to not remember. But it just simply happened that blackout's part of alcoholism. I didn't know that. I was in AA a couple of years, and I was hearing people all the time around the tables talking about it. And finally, I pulled somebody aside, because it took me a couple of years to start asking questions around here. I was afraid. I was afraid, you know, that you'd know I didn't know everything if I'd asked. So I didn't want to ask. And I asked somebody who'd been doing this thing about 100 years about blackouts. And they told me that was not just part of drinking. It was not a piece that everybody who drank enjoyed. It was not alcohol. It was alcoholism that did that. And that was maybe some of my earliest information, good, valid information about my disease. I didn't get this thing real fast. I was a real slow learner when I came in. I wasn't like a lot of you guys. You come in here and you get a hold of this thing and you take off, and it is so exciting. I didn't do that. I was just here trying to stay alive, breathing in and out was all I could do. Well, I left South Carolina by request and returned to the West Coast, and my great uncle was still living. I went back to him for a while. And, you know, they say you can't go home again, and you can't, and that didn't do too well. But there was things going on, you know. There was, Vietnam was going on now, and people were going and coming. The West Coast was just full of ships and fighter jets and transports, and, you know, I had never had anybody pay attention to me in my life, and now all of a sudden people were. It was my behavior they were noticing, but I didn't get it. So anyway, I moved to a Navy town. I moved to San Diego, and I married whoever was second. And he drank like I did. At least he drank like I did then. He did not notice my drinking at all. So he obviously drank like I did. And he liked me pretty well, because he was at sea a lot. And so he would, you know, be gone, and when he'd come home, I was real cute. And you know, you can do that for a while when they don't stay in long. But God, then they come back, and they want you to wash their socks and all that. You know, if you wash their socks, you got them for life. And that's what they told me. Well, I didn't wash many socks. I just kept drinking, so anyway, my drinking got worse, and I don't know whether his did or not, but my behavior with my drinking got worse, and he couldn't stay there, or have me stay there, so So I moved on. Across town, you know, I was still in San Diego. And I met my next relationship, which is the Hell's Angel. And now he lived the kind of life that appealed to me. He lived the way that I thought a person ought to live. It was exciting, and I had never had excitement. I'd never been around anybody who just did what they wanted to do when they wanted to do it, and didn't pay any attention to any authority figures at all. And I thought that was just busy. What a way to go! So I bought into that, and I was there for 3 years. It got real, real sick. My drinking took a back seat to another addiction, and I got addicted to heroin. I didn't drink during that time, just a little bit, and I got so sick. I got down to about 90 pounds, and I was really dying. And we had an attorney that kind of kept all of us out of serious trouble. And he had a real affection for me, and he thought that I was going to die, and he was probably right. And I had a little case, I don't know what it was, some off-the-wall thing. And when he took me to court, he made a deal with the system, and I was really unaware of it. I was so unsophisticated back then, and I didn't know what had taken place, but he dealt me into the California Rehabilitation Center for Women, which is the other side of the women's prison. But in the 60s, that was what they had out there for treatment. That's all they had. They didn't know anything about treatment. CRC was probably 8-9 years old, and they had a 2% success rate at that time across the board. People were dying and nobody knew why, and so they were trying to do something, anything. There were no volleyball nets at CRC. You didn't go on your medical insurance. And I stayed in there for a couple of years. When I got out of there, my angel had gone down for some real bad times, so I didn't have anywhere to go. And I was still a kid, you know. I was 20, 21, something like that. And I didn't know how to take care of myself. I didn't have a clue what a person did to stay alive or survive. But the day they opened the gate, my daddy had moved to California by then with his family, and he met me at the gate, and we went and got drunk. And I was off and running, because drinking wasn't illegal. And so I wasn't going to have to go back there for drinking, and I could drink all I wanted, as long as I didn't stick any more needles in me and do any of that that sick stuff, you know, any of that really bad stuff. I could drink. They will let you drink yourself to death in this country, and really not interfere with you too much, as long as you don't break any major laws or do damage to property or people. And so I set out to try to do that, I guess. And I got drunk that day and stayed pretty continuously drunk. My dad practiced till the end of his life, which was a couple of years ago, but he did not practice alcoholism the way I did. He did not lose everything in his life the way I did. He didn't destroy families the way I did. And he tried to help me. He genuinely, he knew what was wrong with me. He knew what was wrong with both of us. He didn't want to do anything about it. But, you know, it's interesting when our children do the same things we do and suffer the same way we do, whether we want to fix it or not, we still don't want them to hurt like that. And my dad didn't want me to hurt. But he had a family, had a wife and 3 kids, and they didn't want to live like that. You know, there was one thing for him to come stumbling through the door at 2 a.m. It was something else for me to create the kind of chaos I created, so I finally had to go. I just had to get out of there. And of course I didn't know how to take care of myself, didn't know what to do. There'd always been somebody, there'd always been someone to pick up slack for me. So I took up with whoever was next, and eventually married him. We had a daughter, and we stayed together for several years. And that one was all alcohol, just 100% based in alcohol. It's a miracle that she doesn't have fetal alcohol syndrome. But there again, I married somebody who drank like I did. He drank as much as I did. He acted out as much as I did. But he didn't continue to do it like I did. He did not waste his life the way I did. He was able to keep working and taking care of a family and doing the things that are acceptable socially. I never did a socially acceptable thing in my life till I got to AA. And I was involved in a lot of little accidents by that time. I was wrecking a lot of vehicles. I totaled a car once by myself, a single accident difficulty, just flipped it on a curb. I mean, I was real, real hazardous with a car key. And, this poor guy, he was pretty mechanically inclined, but you get tired of fixing cars. And finally, he couldn't cut it anymore. I kept going to jail for weekends, or he'd have to bail me out. Or, you know, back then you could stack up drunk driving charges real bad because things hadn't rocked around in the courts the way they have now. And they start you. It was progressive. They'd start you with like a reckless driving, and then they'd you know, slap you on the wrist, give you a little fine, give you a big fine, do this, do that. They didn't even take your license till about the fifth one. And then you start doing weekends in jail and that kind of thing. And you know, I'd been through all of that. I've done all of that stuff. And every once in a while I'd get real, real whacked out, and they'd take me down to the psych unit. And, you know, I'd kick all the windows out of the car. If they took me to the police department, I wasn't one of those people that sat quietly with her hands cuffed behind her. I was one of the ones face down in the back seat on the floor with a cop's foot on my neck. You know, I couldn't go anywhere quietly, do anything quietly, behave even semi-acceptable. I just had to go kicking and screaming everywhere I went. It was a nightmare for everybody connected with me. And so poor old Bob, he finally just shook his head. He couldn't do me anymore, so he went wherever he went and did whatever he did, and I took his daughter, and I left the state, and I was going to punish him because he couldn't stand me and all that foolishness. But after a while, I was still wrecking cars, and I was still doing crazy things, and I was still going to jails and hospitals, and I think he got real scared about his daughter, and so he took her and just come and got her, and, you know, it was okay if I killed myself, but he would prefer that I did not kill her. And thank God, you know, thank God that people at least get the strength to do what's right, even when it feels wrong, and even when you got to look in people's eyes and know that, you know, that they're going to hate you or that they're going to hurt, just because there is a right way and a wrong way to do things, and I never knew the right way. I never could do anything the right, sane, rational, acceptable way. I didn't know how to be socially acceptable. So I drank a lot. At that period, I drank a great deal, and I decided that I would have a new career. So I went to truck driving school. And this husband, who had the good sense to take his daughter because he thought I was going to wreck the car and kill her, gave me the money to go to truck driving school. I guess he had a bad conscience about breaking my heart. I don't know. anyway, I did that and slicked into a job. And I did pretty well for the first year I was on the road. I drove with a woman, and she had her own truck, and we had a good deal. She didn't care how much I drank, as long as I didn't drink while I was driving, and I didn't. And then I met my last husband, and when my sickness found him right across the highway, was like turn it around and come back and breathe sickness. And we were real sick together for about 15 years. I stayed on the road with him for a long time, and I just lost driver's licenses everywhere. It was just starting when the compacts and the computer hookups were usually 3 and 5 states together. They went the whole nation, and we'd move here and we'd move there, and I changed driver's licenses and I changed names and I this and I. Of course, you've got to remember, I married a lot of folks. I had a lot of names. And I'd keep trading them off and getting new driver's licenses and keep trying to go. And he'd hammer on my head, and I'd get drunk, and we'd go somewhere else and get another driver's license. And it was just a cycle. It was terrible. And finally, I lost the last driver's license that I had out in Arkansas. And I had to get off the truck. I couldn't stay anymore. By that time, our old boy was, I don't know, little something. And he was here. And so I was staying home. And I was able to drink like I really wanted to, and nobody was there to bother me. And he'd come in every, 8-10 days and kick ass and take names and go back on the road. And I'd heal up, and he'd come back. It was pretty much like that. I never got it that that I could maybe not be there when he came in, or any of that, because truck drivers make a lot of money, and it takes money to buy booze. And I didn't know how to take care of myself. Got to remember, all this time I got somebody to do this. It didn't ever occur to me that all those years I worked, I always worked. I just didn't know how to put it together. I didn't know that when you got a paycheck, you paid the light bill. I didn't know that. I just didn't know those things. I didn't understand. I heard my sponsor say one time that she always thought that there was a different set of solutions to every problem. That right and wrong was about what was going on, and it was just like light coming on when she found out that there was just one set of right and wrong behaviors, and they covered everything.
Wow,
what a concept! I didn't know that either. I had a lot in common with her. I guess that's why God let us be together. I didn't know how to live. I didn't have a clue how to live, and I was ending up in hospitals a lot. Broken bones. I had my nose broken several times, and lacerations, and this and that, and you never want to tell them, because it's real, real hard to to talk about it with Quasimodo sitting there beside you, and besides, it's humiliating, because if you talk about it, then they wonder why you get up and leave the hospital, stitches and all, with him. And the last time I went into the hospital, he had come home off the road and assaulted me severely and left the house. And when he came back, I was hemorrhaging pretty bad. And he had done a lot of jail time. He is a career criminal. At this time, he is doing a great deal of time in federal prison. And he didn't want to go to jail for killing me. So he picked me up and took me to the hospital and took me into the emergency room and told them that I had gotten into a bar fight. And that's real important to me to remember that, because what I really had done was I got drunk at my house and he wasn't even there, and I had not done any real damage to anything because I was drunk in my bed when he came in. But the people at the hospital believed what he said because he was sober. That husband didn't drink at all. And when we are drunk, we do not have any credibility. It doesn't matter a whole lot whether I am a victim. It doesn't matter a whole lot whether I am right. If I'm drunk, I have no credibility at all, and nobody believes me. And I was in the hospital for a while. I don't have any concept of time back then, but days at least, maybe years, who knows, before anybody heard my story, before anybody listened to me and believed that that this man had done harm to me. And by then, of course, he was somewhere else, out of state. And excuse me. And they put me back together. They, you know, bound me up with baling wire, and I left there. And I immediately got drunk again. I didn't understand that the alcohol was what had happened to me. I still didn't understand that the reason I stayed in all this trouble was the booze. I thought it was those guys. And I knew that if you just kept looking long enough, you'd find a guy who didn't do those things to you. Because that's what they told me when I was a little girl. That was the deal. You know, smile, look pretty, and don't make waves, and somebody will take care of you. And I bought that. It was in there. It was in my programming, and I believed it. So anyway, I went out and I got drunk again, wrecked another car, and that accident was on the way to the child care center to pick up my little boy. He was, I don't think he was two yet, but he was in the neighborhood of 2 years old, and I was fried. And I went to get him, and the little child seat was in the little restraints over in the passenger side, and I hit a telephone pole on the way over there, and wiped out that side of the car, and it was completely totaled out. I mean, it was leveled over there, and they took me to the hospital, and then they took me to jail. And I didn't grasp the idea that if Brady had been in the car, would have killed him. I didn't get it. I did not. Still, the drinking wasn't the deal. It wasn't. If you had my problems, you'd drink too. Anybody who lived with that guy would have to drink. It just, all these aches and pains, I mean, after you've had everything in you broken and torn up, you hurt all the time. So I needed to drink, and because, of course, I didn't want to stick needles in me, so this was the answer. And I drank some more. I drank a while longer. And it was December that year, 1985, and I got drunk. And Larry was home. He was off the road. He was at home, and he was with Brady. And he had given me the grocery money, and I left to and I got drunk. I pulled my last drunk, and I drove off a cliff, and it was pretty steep, and down the car went all the way down to the bank of the river. I was in North Little Rock, and the Arkansas River is extremely deep right from the bank. They float barges down it, so it goes almost directly down. And anyway, the car went down there, and I was not blacked out when I went off the cliff. I remember being airborne. I do not remember hitting. I obviously hit my head, something, or maybe just went to sleep, who knows. There were no skid marks. I did not tap the brake going over. The car stopped before it went in. The frame hung on something, and it wouldn't go in. But it was hung facing down at the water. And it was so incredible. The car had electric door locks, and it had electric windows and all that stuff. And evidently going down the bank, the doors had bent, so you couldn't kick them open, and you couldn't get the windows down, couldn't get anything to work. And I came to, and I was looking at the water. Now, I've almost killed my child. I've almost been beaten to death. I've I've been everywhere and done everything to everybody that I could, and let everybody who wanted to do anything they wanted to me, and I never got scared. Now I'm looking at this water, and I think I'm going to drown, and I'm scared to death. Now I'm scared. This was my moment of clarity. This was when God talked to me. Right out loud, right in there. And the deal was, I didn't believe I was going to have another chance to do this. I genuinely believed that this was it. This was the bottom line. Either I was going to sober up or I was going to die. And somehow at that moment, I knew that the alcohol was connected with the problem. I didn't understand how. I didn't understand about the alcoholism. But I knew that I wouldn't be off that cliff if I wasn't drunk. So I made a deal with God to not drink anymore. And, you know, you get me through this one and that prayer. And I was as serious as a heart attack, totally sincere, in 85. And I have not had a drink since then. I have not drank alcohol at all. So I went up to the hospital, to the jail, you know, the deal, the cycle. And now this husband, who is so big and mean and ugly and vicious and violent, comes to the jail, sits outside the back door of the jail, and cries. That, you know, every time that one flashes through my brain, I think, God, you know, there's a limit to what a person can really stand. So I felt sorry for him. And and there I went again. And he did. I try to block that from my memory sometimes, but he did. Well, he just sobbed, and I thought, he was probably crying over that car. I didn't drink, and I didn't know where to ask for help, and I didn't know there was any, and I was just crazy. I was genuinely insane. And I started going to church, and Larry's still beating on me all the time, and poor little Grady, God, he was just getting more and more violent, because he was practicing what he was seeing, you know, children do what we show them to do, and everything around them is violent, and that's how they act. And that went on for almost 5 years, and we moved down here, and I had to change churches, and when I got down here, Larry went back on the road, and Grady and I started going to church over on the west side of Lakeland. And by now, Grady's 8 years old, I guess, and he's real, real violent. I mean, just extremely violent, like a man, like a little Hitler. Just punch and kick and fight, square off like a man. Just real, real violent, and I'm getting worse. Because I don't have the booze, and so I'm taking a lot of prescription drugs. I'm having a lot of aches and pains and bones and, you know, whatever, headaches, neuritis, neuralgia, whatever you have, anything that I could go to the doctor and get the white pad for, I got, and so I was taking that stuff all the time, and I didn't know I was taking it to balance my disease. I thought I was taking it for pain, you know. I didn't understand. I was real, real scrambled. But I knew I had to do something about this kid because one of us is going to kill the other one. And so I took him to the minister for counseling, and the minister suggested to me that I try AA, and that offended me because I had not had a drink in almost 5 years, and I told him that I do not drink, and I don't know what your problem is, but I don't drink. And he talked with me about his story. He shared his experience with me, and he had gotten into recovery before he went to seminary. He was alcoholic, and he knew what was going on in my life and my home and in my head. And the more he talked, the more I heard him, and he was the first person that I remembered hearing. And so I went to an AA meeting. I went to an AA meeting that night over on the west side of Lakeland. And everybody was real nice to me and invited me back. And I remember Ted Johnson gave me my white chip, and he said to me when I shared how I got there, he said, well, when I got here, I didn't even have a higher power, and you already have one, so you're miles ahead of me. And they were nice to me, and nobody's been nice to me in a long time. And so I started coming to AA. I went a lot. We had a club over there on the west side that had 4 meetings a day. And we, of course, had the 2720 club. There were a lot of meetings going on all hours of the day. By then I had hurt my leg at my job, and I was off work for a couple of months. And so I could go a lot, and that's what I did. The only time I was not in pain was when I was sitting in meetings. But I didn't really hear anything. I didn't absorb anything that I was told. I went for the fellowship, and when I hear John say that, it really feeds my soul, because we all get here a different way. We all have a different avenue, but it doesn't matter how we got here, and it doesn't matter what it took. It just matters that we're here, and it matters that we go ahead and go forward, because I do not believe there's standing still in AA. I believe that there is going forth and there is going backwards, and backwards is out the door, and I don't want to see any of us do that. But I came for the fellowship. I came because nobody had ever hugged me. Nobody had ever, there was only one reason anybody ever put their hands on me, and when that was done, they took their hands off. And I didn't know about and I wasn't so scattered. I remembered that way out on the West Coast when I was about 18 years old, I was in a drug and they invited me to an AA meeting. Maybe not supposed to do that. And I was in the AA meeting was because I got out of the cell. And I went to the meeting, and a nice little lady gave me a half a cup of coffee, and I didn't know why there was only half a cup there. I thought they didn't have much coffee. and I was jerking all over the place, but I didn't hear anything. And a few years later, while I was married to my daughter's father, in the course of my driving episodes, I was court ordered to 90 AA meetings out on the West Coast again, out in West LA, and I went to all of them, and I didn't. The only thing that I knew was that that AA was there, and I remembered something, and I remembered it the other night when John was sharing. I remember hearing a lady speak, the only speaker that I recall during that entire time. And she said, it was her birthday, and she was talking, and she was happy, and she was gorgeous. And I thought, what is it with these people? And she said, this is what I've always wanted. This was what I looked for in the bars. And I was looking around, and all these old people with all this gray hair were in there, and they were drinking coffee and eating donuts. I said, that's not what I was looking for in the bars. And, so I had to go back out and drink till I had gray hair. But a little at a time, I get those pieces back when I listen to you guys. And so I kept coming. I kept coming. I started going to a ladies' meeting real regular. I got a sponsor. I did what they told me to do because I didn't know anything else to do. I didn't like having people say you got to take direction, but I didn't have any direction. And everything that I was doing was wrong, so anything else that I tried wasn't going to hurt me too bad because I was already in a mess. And if they offered me something, it didn't work, and I tried it, I just ruled it out and got me something else. And I came a pretty good while before I ever opened the book. I tried to read the big book when I first came, and I couldn't read two sentences and make any sense. So I just had to listen to people talk to me. And there were several people around the room who were real knowledgeable about what was in that book. Ron was one of them. Valley was one of them. People who quote the book at the table, and I think that's very important because some of us cannot read the book when we get here. And they tell you don't drink and go to meetings and read the big book, and if you can't read the big book, how else will we find out what it says except by the old-timers who tell us what it says? So, you guys that know it, keep talking about it because there's folks coming through the doors every day that may not be able to read it. After a while, I realized that it was not all in the fellowship, that there were some things that I had to do. Got a friend that says that if you think that sitting at the table in AA will give you recovery, then you need to go home and put a chair in your garage and sit in it and see how long it takes you to be a car. There are some actions that we have to take, and those actions are the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And a little at a time, I came to realize that that was up to me. That wasn't about what somebody else was going to do, that somebody else was going to do for me. Now, here I am, 40-odd years old. Now I got to learn to take care of myself. Okay, I don't know how to do this. I really don't. Husband's gone to federal prison. I got this kid. I'm all by myself. I don't have a clue how to live in the real world. And I had to learn how to ask for help. I had to learn how to reach out my hands. I had to learn how to say, I don't know how to do that. Please show me. And God, I hated that. I didn't want to tell anybody I didn't know anything. They would think I knew everything. And so I had to get there from where I was, and that was a tough spot. I knew I was powerless over alcohol. I knew that. By then, I knew that I could not drink. I had absorbed enough information in the rooms to realize that I had an allergy. And if I drank, I didn't stop. I would go back in my mind to all the years of drinking, and I would remember that every time I ever didn't drink, it was because something outside myself stopped me. Once I drank, I could not stop. So that indicated to me strongly that that I had what you all told me you had. And you said I could stay. And the more alike I was with you all, the better chance I thought I had of getting to stay. Today, the more alike I am with you all, the better chance I have of getting to stay alive. And staying alive is real important to me. My life was unmanageable, no question about that. I didn't have a problem with that. The power greater than myself came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. So you got to remember, I'm in the church for almost 5 years on my knees, praying, begging God to heal me of this insanity, and steady wanting to get drunk, taking these pills, doing whatever I have to do, beating my brains out. So I knew that there was a power, but whether or not it was going to relieve my insanity was, that was questionable to me. I had a little trouble with that. And I had to get a new concept of God. I had to gentle my God. I had to give him some dimension. I had to realize that he was a lot bigger and a lot more powerful than I had ever given him credit for being. And I had to realize that there were some things up to me that God was not going to just reach down here and take responsibility for me. I'm going to have to ask him. I'm going to have to give it to him. So at that point, whenever that was, I believe that I probably did take the third step. I just just gave it up to God because I couldn't do it myself anymore. And I was afraid. I was afraid then. And on a daily basis, on a regular basis, I go through those first three steps while I'm brushing my teeth. It's like it's a constant daily thing of turning my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand him. I can't do anything. There is so little I have any effect on at all. So little. And God helps me when I ask him. He gives me who I need to see. He has people say to me what I need to hear. He offers me whatever help I need. And all I really have to do is offer me to him. I had a home group by then. And there was a man that talked a lot about the steps, and I didn't know much, and didn't want to mess with that, and sure didn't want to write anything. And I didn't go to school much because I was always getting married, and so I didn't have any education. I was real illiterate. And the book described this process of the fourth step. And you got to write this stuff and take all this stuff and these columns. And I had this picture of this literary work that somebody was going to see, and it was going to be a big, major undertaking. And I was terrified that somebody was going to see what I wrote down and know that I was a moron and not let me stay here. And I didn't want to do it. And Wyatt said to me one night, well, how long do you want to be sick? I don't want to be sick. I don't want to be perceived as sick.
I mean, now, this litany of a life that I have, now all of a sudden I don't want to be perceived as sick. So, still I have not reached a place where I can laugh. You've got to understand that I had not heard the ring of laughter from my voice in a long time. I took myself so damn seriously. But I said, well, all right, I'll, and I heard Ron say at a meeting, God, this was wonderful. He says, well, you can't show up at your fifth step without at least a few notes. And I thought, oh, you mean I don't have to write them damn columns. So that helped me a lot. That really, really helped me. And I showed up at my fifth step with a few notes. And we did that. I got safe enough from a lot of hours, not all in AA meetings, because I have to stay sober 24 hours a day. So I spent a lot of hours with recovering women, and I learned to know them, and I learned a little at a time to let them know me, so that I felt safe enough to share who I am with them and not be fearful that they would that they would throw me away, or that they would ridicule me, or you know, whatever it was, get in a pissing contest with them. I just really had to trust somebody before I could get up off any of my garbage. And I was sitting in Mary Shaw's kitchen one night with my notes in my purse, which is where they lived, for fear that somebody would find them. What if a burglar came in and saw my footsteps? You know, I knew this stuff. So, you know, I really did take them seriously. Anyway, we're sitting there, and she's ironing her work clothes, and we just started talking, and as we talked, we went through some chunks of my life, and we addressed some of my defects of character, which I was not aware existed. I didn't know that, like I didn't know that I ran. I didn't know that one of my primary difficulties in life was running away from everything, was terror of confrontation. I was so afraid of people, and so we just always ran from everything, husbands, kids, doctors, lawyers, it didn't matter. School, jobs especially. I never got fired from a job for alcoholism. And when I came here and people talked about losing their jobs to alcoholism, oh, I'm different. You know, that didn't happen to me. Because I always ran out the back door before they fired me. I didn't like them, so I didn't stay. They didn't do to suit me, so I'm out of here. I'm parking my car, whatever. You know, I'm gone. I didn't understand that was my flaw. I believed that the reason I had moved to all those many states and done all those geographic things was because this 15-year marriage was to a career criminal truck driver, and they move a lot. And when we addressed that portion of my life, we came to the understanding that in my memory, I remember I got some blackout and don't even remember some places, I had moved 86 times, and I lived in the same house until I was 13 years old. So I was already a gypsy before Larry ever got me, and I just went out and found somebody that could breed to my disease, and I could go with it. Get some of it. And so I just so that helped me. That really helped me. To look at me instead of out here at those guys, because those guys were not even in the house. They were not even in the city, and I'm still blaming them for all the things that are hurting me and all the pain that I have. And if it wasn't for those guys, I wouldn't suffer like this. And you know that deal. And it wasn't those guys. It was Brenda and her sick shit stuff. And so we went through my defects in that way. Once I got to a place where I could say that stuff out loud, I could laugh at it, and I started to hear me laugh out loud, and I started to enjoy being with people and letting them know me and showing me to them and sharing who I had been and who I was becoming. And then I could ask for help to help me become a better person, to go forward, to go further toward being a better person. The sixth step became entirely ready to have all my defects of character removed. It's a small little step, and it's simple except for entirely and all. and absolutes give me some trouble. So I have to remember that everything in recovery is progressive. My disease is progressive, recovery is progressive. At the point that I did my first, fourth, and fifth step, I became entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. That's some years ago. Today, I am working on different defects of character that didn't bother me one damn bit 6 years ago. They were simple stuff compared to the things that were hurting me and killing me and breaking my heart back then. But they're hurting me and killing me and breaking my heart today. And so today we address them. And it's all the same process. It's a constant thing. Now I'm working on this new stuff. And I have to become entirely ready to have God remove all these defects. Humbly ask him to remove my shortcomings. And I like that step a lot. I like the idea of humbling myself before God. This week, particularly, I have felt very humbly grateful for my life. And I have constantly thanked God that I'm living and breathing and have some freedom, because I am free. I'm not happy and joyous all the time. I got some of that. But I am a free person today. I genuinely am free. I buried a friend this afternoon, and it was horrible. It was so painful. A young woman, and she took her own life because she couldn't get free. She couldn't live. She couldn't find a way to stay alive. So she only could find the answer to just stop living. And no, I don't know why it was different than that for me. Because there were years and years and years of my life that my first thought was to get drunk, and now when I couldn't get drunk enough, the next thought was to taste gun oil. Years of this was what was in the front of my brain. Well, I'll just do myself, and then it'll be okay. See, I don't think that way anymore. That's not an option today. Today I don't think along those lines. Today I think along the lines of, I don't know what the answer is. I don't know what the solution is, but there is one, because if it's a problem, it's got another side. And I'm real grateful for that. And I feel very, very humble. When I came to the eighth step, that list of mine was very, very long. It remains long. There are a lot of people that I ran roughshod over. There are a lot of lives that I damaged and wounded. And so I had to become ready to make amends, willing to make amends. The step says became willing. And willing, I believe, is the cornerstone to recovery. In everything I do, in everywhere, in every aspect of my life, it is willingness that I have to have. God does everything else if I'm willing to give to him what I can't do. And so I think that, you know, the ninth step is a real progressive thing. It was indicated to me that you do not wash up on the shores of Alcoholics Anonymous and run out and make amends to everybody today. It's good if we get a little recovery, we get a little help. And each issue and each situation, talk over with somebody who's been here a while, been doing this thing a little while, and can understand the implications. We've got legal implications and moral implications. We've got others. We've got career implications. I don't believe that except where it would wound them or others means that I'm an other. And I argue that. Always. I do not believe I'm another. I think that's a cop-out when people don't want to clean up sufficiently, when people don't want to dig deep enough. They are an other, and they don't want to wound themselves, and I don't buy that, because in pain is how I grow, in pain is how I heal, and when I'm unwilling to feel pain, that's when I go back to alcohol, that's when I go back to drinking, that's when I go back to anesthetizing myself with whatever outside myself I use to make me feel better. So I don't buy that part. But I do think that time and care should be taken in making amends. And I don't think that amends are all about who I wound. There is the area of forgiveness. There's the area of abuses and painful interactions that have come to me. And if I cannot forgive people, then I'm not free. I'm not free to live and think and come and go and be anywhere that I want. I'm as bound and restricted as I was when I was a child. So I have to forgive people for whatever their sickness is if I want to be forgiven for mine. And not a little bit at a time, I've let go of a lot of that. Laughter is a great healer. I have found that that laughing at some of that stuff has made it a lot easier for me. I've let go of a lot of old hatred and anger that I didn't think I would. I believed I'd carry it to my grave. I believed that it was justified and I had every right to it. But that's not the deal. Me hating you don't hurt you. Me hating me may kill me. And I just can't do it. The tenth step, I think, is a constant thing. And we rob ourselves. We rob ourselves of peaceful sleep. We rob ourselves of some real happy, joyous, and free time if we do not continuously clean house. And that doesn't mean that I just look at what the wrongs I've done. It means that I look at who I've been today. How have I treated other people? How have I let people treat me? Because it's partly about boundaries. It's partly about who I am and how I'm perceived. I didn't have any boundaries before. I was willing to put up with anything from anybody just to have somebody there. And I'm not anymore. I do you no service if I let you abuse me. And you do me no service if you let me abuse you. So I try to look at who I have been. Have I been who I say I am? Have I tried to do the best I could? What have I done that I'm not real happy about? And how can I do it better? What have I done that I am proud of? And I try to do it on a regular basis because the big book tells me that if I do that every night, I can sleep. And I don't lose a lot of sleep anymore. When I got here, my bed looked like a war zone every morning, and I did not sleep well. And now, when I rise up out of my bed in the morning, it just looks like somebody slept there. The sheets are still on the bed. The 11th step is growing for me. And I guess this is the time. I have a friend up in Lakeland, Mike Martin, and he says that it takes 5 years to put together a program, and then the second 5 years you're here, you kind of test it to see if it works, and then you start seeking spirituality. Well, I'm testing mine to see if it will work, and I'm looking for a higher plane all the time. I'm reaching. Because the God of my understanding is growing and changing, and the universe is growing and changing for me. Things are bigger. It's more awesome than I thought it was. Everything was small and compact and kind of black and white in my life before, and things are taking on new dimensions. I have more trust, have more faith than I've ever had. I know that things happen the way they're supposed to happen. When I was sitting there listening to the clergyman speak over Martha today, I was looking around the room and I was thinking how sad and what a waste it is to lose someone. And she suffered from our disease and never got here. And so I always relate it to myself and how blessed I am to have the lesson. I don't have to go there. I don't have to do that. My sponsor said to me not too long ago that she could not get well in the church either. She could not get healed in the church, and she tried. She came from a Bible Belt background, and she said that when they told her that Jesus died on the cross for her, it made her feel guilty, and she didn't know why he did that, and she felt worse about herself than she did before. And when someone told her that a lady alcoholic died so she wouldn't have to, it made perfect sense to her. And that makes perfect sense to me, and I get to live. And I didn't realize that I was running out of time. I'm so blind. Forgive me. And I believe that 12th step is everything we do. Everything we do. Everybody we talk to. Everything we touch. I believe that we are responsible for healing each other. I don't believe that it's in Skid Row bars. I believe that it is with each other anywhere we are. And anytime we're asked and anytime that it looks like I need to reach out my hand and ask. When this thing came together, my understanding is not that the drunks went to find AA. My understanding is that AA found the suffering alcoholic. And I believe that that is our job. I do not believe that I sit here and I wait for somebody to come over and ask me for my number. I believe I go to the newcomer and I give it to her. I believe I let her know that I am available to her. I believe that if God gives me a car, it is my job to go pick somebody up and take them to a meeting. I think that the blessings that I get are in relation to the way that I operate in God's blessings. And I thank you all very much for listening to me. And I'm sorry I ran so long.
Thank you.